The Daily Connect Podcast.
It's Monday the 7th of January, of course, and it is Stephen Scott back with you for another year on the programme. Thank you so much for downloading. Now, coming up, we are going to hear from Gordon Anthony, one of our regular listeners, who is here to tell us all about his book, Hunting Icarus, and how he came to write that, and also a rather interesting story about how it ended up becoming an audiobook. That's on the way. Also joining us, we will have Blind Dave Healy, who has a rather sad story to tell us, as he had to put his guide dog Seamus down at Christmas, on Christmas Day of all days. So we're going to hear that news a little bit shortly. But first, we are going to hear about Shared Spaces, part of our regular campaigns update here on the Daily Connect programme. And we're going to kick off with news about Ealing Council, who had to scrap a scheme after RNIB campaigners got involved to tell councillors there that the planned cycle route, which was going to be built onto a pavement in Ealing, wasn't really suitable for blind people. Doesn't seem too surprising, does it, when you say it out loud, but this was something which Ealing Council had to get RNIB involved in to explain. Now, the planning for all of this was a traffic consultation. That's what it comes under. And for that reason, the decision was taken to put leaflets through people's doors. And of course, that meant that blind people couldn't read those leaflets and meant they couldn't be aware or wouldn't be aware of what was coming. Well, one of the campaigners, Rosemary, who got in touch with us, told us all about why she decided to get involved in the campaign and why she wanted to engage with RNIB to make sure this scheme would, in fact, become stopped. And that's exactly what happened. Rosemary spoke to Alan Russell.
My husband would say I've got the personality of a Rottweiler. A nice Rottweiler, a friendly Rottweiler, but I don't like things being put into place without proper consultation and without the proper use of the whole community being involved.
So are you a guide dog owner or a white cane user?
I'm a white cane user, but I have got some sight.
So presumably, or obviously, you know, shared space environments like this are difficult to navigate and potentially dangerous as well.
Yes, very. It's not actually on my road. I'm a turning from the road of the proposed shared pathway, but because of the geography of my area, it's the road that I use for catching buses, catching trains, going to the doctors, going to the shops, and actually use it much more than other roads in the locality. What set the alarm bells ringing was the fact that we've got quite a vibrant residents association, of which I am a member and my husband delivers the magazines, and they were alerted to the fact that there was going to be traffic consultation, which included the shared pathway use. And so, because I'm registered blind, I thought that I would get involved in campaigning against it.
You mentioned the consultation there, Rosemary, but the problem, I think, there straight away was it wasn't accessible, despite the council having access to the register that could tell them who has sight loss.
Exactly. The consultation didn't include people that with sight loss because it was just a leaflet pushed through the letterboxes. But equally, because, as I've said, the geographic layout of the area means that lots of people in the adjoining roads also use that road, they should have also been consulted. And therefore, we decided the consultation was illegal.
What action did you take?
I personally contacted the local councillors, one of whom I know very well, also our local MP, and through the councillors, I was able to access the officer at the town hall that was involved in this actual project. I am able to use an iPad, so I was accessing them through that by emails, but I also backed it up with some phone calls as well. There was an event. There is a local ward forum which meets 3 times a year, and the first one was held early on when the consultation first happened and the legality of the consultation was brought up, and they promised there would be a second one. Lots and lots of residents were encouraged to go to that, so that was a big thing.
So yourself, along with others, took action because of this proposal, which, you know, we'll reiterate again, wasn't accessible if you're blind or partially sighted to get all that info. What was the outcome?
The outcome's been brilliant. Although they're carrying on with the traffic order, the shared pathway has definitely been dropped. Absolutely wonderful news. That's not in any little effect from the RNIB. There was Samantha Fothergill, whom we met. The Residents Association secretary organised a meeting that Samantha and her colleague came to. And as a result of that, they wrote a very strong letter against the equal opportunities and the consultation being faulty, etc. So the local residents, myself, are grateful to Samantha Fothergill and RNIB's involvement.
So it really shows, Rosemary, you know, getting involved with RNIB, getting involved with the campaigns can and does make a difference.
Yes, you need to make yourself aware of the legal side of things so that you're not just saying, I don't like a shared pathway because it makes me feel uncomfortable and unsafe and all of the obvious things. You need to get involved or find out about the legalities of things and where they've made blunders, really. I think that's what swung it.
That is Rosemary talking there to Alan Russell. And if you would like to get involved with RNIB campaigns, then here is the number you need, 0303 123 99. Double nine. That's 0303 123 9999. That number is for RNIB's helpline.
The Daily Connect podcast.
Now, it's a time of celebration at Christmas and New Year, but unfortunately for our Dave Healy, who's a regular contributor to our Afternoon Edition programme, you might have heard him there talking about DIY and a whole wide range of other topics. Well, it wasn't such a good New Year for him, or indeed a good Christmas either. He spoke to Simon Polly to explain.
You know, I'm hoping that 2019 is a much happier year yet. Sadly, in a nutshell, mate, I lost Seamus, my guide dog. He's been off the ropes for 12 months or more, you know, with one thing and another. But, you know, hindsight's a funny old thing, and it's, you know, we realise now. But we put it down to the fact that he was coming 9, you know, he's a big lad, and he was beginning to slow down, and anybody who's got a guide dog will understand what I'm saying now. He was having a few spending issues, and, you know, you think, oh, here we go, you know, retirement's coming, because he was semi-retired, and I am, in fact, waiting on a new dog. But the Sunday before the Christmas Eve, I nipped up the local for a couple, and Seamus was very stop start, and I'm sort of saying to him, come on, old pup, what's the matter? And I'm thinking, oh, you know, don't spend all the way up. Anyway, we got to the pub and he was fine, no problem, come out after a couple of beers, and then he walked down home as right as 9 pence, to be fair. But I got in, and following morning, which was the Christmas Eve morning, I said to Deb, I said, we're taking him up the park, yep, have a free run. And I said, do us a favour. I said, just follow behind and just watch me work him. I said, he was a bit strange last night. And we come out of the house, we turned left off the drive, and Deb said, he just cut me straight up, stood straight in front of me side on. And it was then basically he sort of saying, I ain't going nowhere. So I dropped the harness, and me and Deb sort of slowly went up to the park and let him off. He had a bit of a free run. He was running all right, but he a bit subdued. And we were due up the vets that day because they put him on a low-fat food and they hadn't got much, so I had to go and sort of stock up for him for Christmas. And when I rang in to say, yeah, had they got the delivery in? Yes, Dave, they had. And I explained to Janet, who was, she's been a vet who's been at this practice for, oh, blimey, through all of my guide dogs. And now Seamus, and I said, well, you know, it's X, Y, and Z. And she says, it ain't going to hurt, bring him up. So off we tootles in the car to the vets, went in. Straight away, she said, he's not looking well. And Deb was explaining different things to me. So she took a blood sample, and she says, I'm not liking the blood sample. I said, okay. So she said, I'd like to do an abdominal test. And I went, okay, she explained, and obviously, Seamus was not too happy with this, which he's never too happy. If you touched his foot or his nose or his ear, he's never too happy. And she said, no, I'm not too happy with the results. I would rather him have a scan. We ain't got the facility here, and you need to take him to the emergency vet, which was, you know, a few miles away, which was, yeah, okay, no problem. So we dropped him up there, and they said, look, you know, leave him, and we'll ring you later, and we'll give you some answers. We'll let you know what's happening. So we came back home about 4, and then on the evening, he'd be about half past 11, quarter to 12, we had the phone call to say that, unfortunately, through the scan, they'd found that internally Seamus had got a tumour, which was 150 mil, as they quoted, 6 inches, as I know, and there was a large amount of blood in his intestines, which they were not happy with. And because of the situation, they suggested, being as it was Christmas Eve and they couldn't get everything they wanted, that would we take him to a place called Willows in Solihull. And so we shot out in the car, picked him up, and sort of up at 2-3 o'clock on Christmas morning, we were at the Willows, being Deb and myself and Seamus. What a place, Simon. And I have to say, what a place, a wonderful place. It's probably the Booper of the dog world. It was fantastic, and the people there were wonderful, you know, very calming and whatnot. And I said, well, we've got a scan, we've had the results. Things are not looking too good, but, you know, we can see what we can do. And I said, look, leave him. He'll be settled. We'll settle him down. We don't want him, you know, upset. And I said, okay. So off we trots back home. We got in the house about 4 Christmas morning. And then about 11:30 on the Christmas day, we were sort of finishing breakfast and doing a few things and wondering and worrying. And they had a phone call to tell me that they'd basically operated. Things were not right inside, which I won't go into what they said. And they said, look, you know, it's a decision for you to make. We can bring him out of anaesthetic and he may, with medication, go on another couple of days. And the fairest thing that, you know, as a family, we said no. So we had to make that decision, which no day in the year is a good day, Simon. But Christmas Day was not the best day to make a decision such as. But bless him, he's at peace, he's out of pain. And so we had to say goodbye to Seamus on Christmas morning.
Such a sad story, but we do wish Dave all the best. This is The Daily Connect.
The Daily Connect podcast.
Now, finally in the podcast, we are going to talk about books, and in particular, one audiobook by Gordon Anthony. Now, Gordon is visually impaired himself, and he spoke to our very own Red Sail about writing his book, Hunting Icarus.
Gordon Anthony is the author of several historical novels, including Hunting Icarus, set during the latter days of the First World War in what is now Iraq. It follows the lives of two young flyers, one German, one British, facing each other over the desert. Their flying machines may be primitive, but aerial combat is just as deadly as that in the trenches. It's a gripping tale, and there's also a story behind the talking book version. Gordon joined me down the line from his home in Scotland to tell me more.
I wanted to let people know that the war in the Middle East with the British Army is not a new phenomenon, and I have always been particularly interested in the air war, or the First World War. It's just been an area I've studied a lot out of personal interest. So I eventually came up with this story, which essentially follows two pilots, one British and one German, who are both sent out to Mesopotamia under various political manoeuvres. I'll try and cover the political scene a little bit as well. But it follows their adventures and their opposition and the pretty dreadful conditions that they both operated in. And I try to show both the differences and also the similarities between the two sides and the difficulties that they all faced together, and really the futility and the dreadful waste of the First World War.
The historical knowledge that comes through it is, it's fascinating. It's clearly very, very well researched. I know that you too suffer from sight loss, and
I think one of the things that I found very difficult when writing is to be able physically to do that research. How did you go about doing it?
Well, as I say, I've had a lifelong interest, and it's only in the last 10 years or so that I've lost my sight. So I'd read many, many books beforehand. And, of course, you know, technology is pretty wonderful. I wanted to reread some of the old books to refresh my memory on things. And I also investigated new books that I could read. So I was able to download them onto my Kindle, which reads the books aloud to me, which was great. It was a case of trying to, you know, having to stop it occasionally and take a note. I must remember that part. You know, that's important. And basically filling my mind with as much as possible. On the technical aspect of some of the aircraft, which are, of course, very difficult to recall. I mean, how do you remember the maximum airspeed and the maximum endurance of a particular plane and so on? I did many, many years ago, when I was still at school, I bought a couple of books which listed every single aircraft which flew in the First World War, no matter which side produced it, and it had a brief outline of the aircraft service and the technical specs. And I was quite fortunate that what I did was I gave these books to my mother and said, "Type those out for me." So it meant that I did. I have a whole host of a folder on my computer with a whole host of technical documentation, and I can look up any particular one and find out the details of a particular aircraft when I need it. Because I think the historical background is one of the most important parts of any historical novel. I mean, the story is the main thing. You've got to have a story, and you've got to be able to. They're written for entertainment, but they're also written to inform. And if you get the historical background right, then I think that comes through, and the readers appreciate that you've done your homework, because there's nothing annoys me more than reading a historical novel, and I've read some First World War novels, and I read it, and that's not right. And it puts me off the story, no matter how good the story is.
You have lost your sight, I believe, to retinitis pigmentosa?
That's correct, yeah.
But you've also used some of the skills that you learnt in your long career to go out and talk to audiences about sight loss and contribute your own rather wry sense of humour to what can, as we all know, be a very painful process. I rather love your book, A Walk in the Dark. Could you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, I wrote that a few years ago when I could still see a bit. I mean, obviously you're registered blind, people don't realise you still have some vision, but I was going through the stage where I knew I was going to go blind and my vision was fading rapidly. And I just wanted to raise awareness of it a little bit. So I wrote a very short booklet, really, of some of the adventures that I'd had. And I tried to put a humorous spin on it because my way of dealing, everybody deals with it in their own way. My way of dealing with it is always to try and make a bit of a joke out of things that go wrong. Now, that's not to say I don't have my moments, because I do. You know, sometimes I'll get really, really frustrated or upset if I do something stupid or whatever. But generally, I do try and make a bit of a laugh at it. And the family helped in that respect as well. So, yeah, I wrote that booklet and I put it up on my website, but I've also got it on the Kindle store. I put it at the lowest price I could put on, and any royalties that I get from it, I send on to RNIB. So if your listeners are interested, buy a few copies, that'll generate a few more pounds for RNIB.
And you've also mentioned your family. You've clearly got a very supportive family, and I know that your sister Moira is actually responsible for having Hunting Icarus made into a talking book. She raised the funds for it, didn't she?
Yeah, she did. She did an absolutely fabulous job. Yeah, my family generally are very supportive. It came about because I was asked by RNIB Scotland to give a talk. They were trying to raise awareness of talking books, and because I've written several novels, and only one of them was at that stage in the talking book library, I gave this talk, and Moira came along to it to help as one of my sighted guides and just to listen and give a bit of support. And when she was there, she actually, after the talk, she had a chat with Angela Preston of RNIB Scotland, who had organised the thing. And Angela is one of these people you speak to, she persuades you to do things. And Moira volunteered to try and raise some money.
It was a daily ritual, designed to keep the frontline troops exhausted. The trench lines were usually quiet during the day because most activity was carried out under cover of darkness. When night fell, men would crawl out into the mud between the lines to lay and repair barbed wire fences or to raid the enemy's trenches. Such raids were terrifying ordeals when men armed with coches, knuckle dusters, Mills bombs and revolvers would attempt to cut a path through the enemy wire and capture an unprepared soldier from the other side. Except that the other side was never unprepared.
Andrew Loudon narrating Hunting Icarus, written by my guest Gordon Anthony, which is talking book number 24289. And you can find other books by Gordon Anthony, including his memoir of blindness, A Walk in the Dark, online wherever you buy your books.
Thanks to Red Sail talking there to Gordon Anthony, and that is it for the podcast today. We're back, as always, tomorrow from 5 on the podcast, live on air from 10.
The Daily Connect Podcast.